So the theme for this retreat has been the four resolves. And it might not be the best English choice to call them resolves, especially if we associate them with getting stern or too serious in some kind of, hard way. But the word adhitana, the Pali word, in my sense of Buddhism and Indian Buddhism and the words that they used, it seems to me that it's one of those words that has, kind of a sacred word or points to something that's so special, so important, so heartfelt or meaningful that kind of points to something that's almost sacred or something that has that kind of, or something similar to that in people's lives. It's a very important concept or idea. And you could stretch the word to mean taking a stand, a place that you can stand, some place that's reliable, or a place where you can be rooted, or if there's floods that are streaming, currents and rivers are flooding over and everything's flooded, then you want to stand on an island that's in high ground where you're safe. And so sometimes someone who has some degree of liberation is said to have found dry ground or found the island to stand on, and they're not caught up in the currents of attachment and greed and hatred and delusion and can swirl around in society and be quite a challenge to live in, live through, live with. And so the idea of standing on some reliable ground. The discourse, the particular teachings of the Buddha, talks about these four resolves. He talks about them clearly in contrast to being swept up in what the translation says, the tides of conceiving. So the currents of conceiving. And what this means is, the word conceiving is a brilliant English translation of a word in Pali, which also means imaginings, thoughts that are imaginary thoughts. We imagine things, we make things up. But I like the word conceiving, or conception, because of the double meaning of it. Conceiving can mean in English to think something up, or to imagine something, or to think of something. But it also means to conceive means to give birth to something, to conceive a life, conceive children or something. Something gets conceived, So what is it that your thoughts give birth to? And do you give birth to imaginary thoughts? And then you live in the imaginary world of what your minds can conceive and make up. And I think it's true probably for many people that a good percentage of their life is lived through their thoughts, with their thoughts, in their ideas, in their imaginary ideas of what is, what's going to be. I know that I spent a lot of time conceiving a future, inventing a future that never happened. And a lot of that came along with anxiety about what was going to happen and plans of how to take care of what was going to happen, only to be surprised that it didn't happen. At least, maybe you have a better success rate at predicting the future, but mine was rather abysmally poor. And after a while, because I was paying some attention to what I was doing, I started noticing how poor my success rate was. And it finally dawned on me how poor it was. I began loosening up. I didn't quite believe it anymore. I didn't quite invest myself in those plans anymore and thoughts. And I became much more relaxed about what was coming and more willing to show up. And I would plan and prepare a little bit, but more willing to just show up and figure it out when I had the real evidence of what was going on rather than just what I was imagining. Some people spend a lot of time imagining a past. Sylvia Boorstein talks about imagining a better past. So we have our past and we kind of tell stories about it, we imagine it or figure out what we could have said, what we should have said, what could have happened, what we should have happened. And so some of that's reasonable. Planning is reasonable to do some. But to live in this world of conceiving, many studies have shown that people's memory of the past can be rather creative. And while at the same time, they're convinced that they remember accurately. And then when the studies show that actually it can be quite different. And or it grows, you know, the fish gets longer for every telling. So the stories get somehow switches and changes. And then we conceive all kinds of ideas about who we are. Or we internalize conceptions that other people have made up about who we are, how we are, judgments about us. And some of these ideas could have some basis in reality and truth, but sometimes it's not really anything that anybody should be living in or living by. And they're not useful, some of these ideas and projections and internalizations of values and conceit. Ideas of self that, and I remember when I was maybe I've been practicing Zen for about probably 3 years, and it became increasingly obvious how much conceiving I had around conceit, around ideas of who I was, and especially how I wanted people to see me. And the social gymnastics I went about to try to convince people that this is who I am, you know, explaining to them, you know, you know this about me, and this is, you know, trying to convince them, or show them, or have a certain effect on people. And I saw how much selfing there was, how much self-concern there was, and how much fear there was around self and being judged and being seen and being accepted. And it was great when when I came to San Francisco Zen Center. It was really helpful for me because I was still playing these social games, and the people there, especially the senior people, they didn't respond the way that they were supposed to. Yeah, like they weren't playing along. You know, I would meet with this kind of impassive, you know, presence, you know, like, and so it became a mirror for me, and I thought, these are really wise people. And some of them were, but later I got to know them, and it turned out they were just kind of aloof. But that was nice. It worked for me, because it became a mirror, and I saw how much, you know, I was doing this, you know. You know, it really helps to try to do something, conceive of something, and try to get it out there, and it doesn't, you know, the only place it lands is back on you. It doesn't just. So then I saw that, I didn't want to base my life on this anymore. I wanted to be able to let go of it, to relinquish it. And the feeling I had was that I was standing at the edge of a cliff, and there was this big abyss, big hole, big, you know, and for me to let go of but this effort to try to be a self and make a self and prove a self and defend a self and project a self that I was involved in, it was just too scary. And, you know, I couldn't take that step into over the cliff. And so I knew that someday I'd have to do it. But I also knew I wasn't ready. I couldn't do it yet. So it took a while before that time came. And I actually never really saw it happen, but at some point I recognized it had dropped away. But I did make a ritual for myself to try to do it, and that was, I the second time I went to practice in Asia, I decided to make, I thought that was a big transition, going to a new place to practice. And so I made the international date line, the ritual. If I crossed that date line, then that was going to be the marking point of letting it go. And so, you know, I don't think it worked that easily, but but I think that having that ritual, having that idea, somehow gave me a little bit of more, I don't know if courage is the right way, but it was a little extra kind of push, like, you know, you're kind of, this is what you're doing. You know, I wasn't going to hold back so much anymore. But these, you know, conceivings and ideas that swirl. And so some people come to the point of their life where it doesn't make sense to base their lives on what they were, what they have been basing it on. It no longer makes sense to base it on, you know, on conceit. Doesn't make sense to base it on greed. Doesn't make sense to base it on hate or resentment, or doesn't make sense to base it on fear anymore. You know, some people rely on fear to find their way, or they wouldn't say they're based their life on fear, but in principle they are. Or they don't want to base their life on status, or don't want to base their life on other people's expectations or other people's projections and confusions. And there's all these values, you know, sometimes family values are not the values we want to live by. Sometimes values of our friends or our society around us, not the values we want to live by. I remember after I went to college, first year of college, I went back to see one of my high school friends, and it was so dramatic that, you know, our values had gotten so different from each other that it just wasn't comfortable for me to kind of continue in that friendship. And maybe if I had been much more mature, I would have found a way to, but I just was so uncomfortable that the only thing I knew how to do was to step away. So the, you know, what are the values we want to base our life on, and how does that change over time? And, you know, some of the things I was quite concerned about in high school, you know, are not really things to base a life on, even though they seem so important in high school. You know, a face that didn't have zits. Pretty important. Or the length of my hair. And that was particularly important back when you were in the hippie times. It's 1967, which was like, you know, the beginning of Summer of Love and all that. I spent that year in class tugging on my hair, trying to get it to grow faster. Probably not the best use of the Summer of Love. So at some point, many people come, when they do this practice, I think at some point many of people come to the point where they want to switch. And some of the values, some of the intentions, some of the purposes they live under no longer make sense. And that can be particularly acute when it has to do with a lot of the ideas of who we are as a self, my identity, that somehow this, the way I'm caught up in identity issues and being someone and holding on to that, or, you know, somehow has run its course. Maybe it was valuable and important at a certain point in life. Certainly identities are very important and have their role. But at some point it's like, I think that this is not what I want to do. I don't want to keep, it's kind of tiring to hold on to the identity issues and be this way. And so sometimes there's a desire to shift and let go. But then the question is, what do we replace it with? If we're not basing ourselves on some of the old principles, ideas, values, sense of self, what can we base our life on? if everything's always impermanent and changing, is there something that's not so permanent that we can rely on, base our life on? If we're not going to have a self that's kind of the central organizing principle for how we live our life, then what is going to be the central organizing principle? Or is it just chaos and we're just at sea, you know, floating around with aimlessly without any purpose? I believe that the Buddha's teachings offers purpose and meaning and value to our lives by pointing to something that is reliable, something that is valuable for ourselves and our society. And this idea of the four resolves, four places to stand, is pointing to places that are reliable, values that are useful and that are worthwhile being oriented around these things. In the Zen tradition, they have the same issue, and there they talk about vows. Turns out to be also four vows that they live by. And the word vow in Sanskrit is pranidhana, also has kind of a sacred feeling to it, like adhidhana. And the idea that you would, in Zen they talk about everything being empty, so what do you base your life on? Well, you base your life on the vows. And the vow, the first one is the vow to save all beings, so the vow of being compassionate. And for me, when I was a Zen student, these four vows were very important. The vow to save all beings, the vow to end all desires, the vow to overcome all delusions, the vow to kind of become the Buddha's way. It was an important step for me to kind of take those intentions and make them. But it wasn't really taking them. And what was important for me was, at some point as I practiced, that you know, I let go of enough sense of self, enough of my attachments, and all this world, this abstract world of imaginations that I had been living in, of conceivings, began to fall away. And I wasn't left with nothing. I was left with an upwelling within that I call a responsiveness to the world. You know, that we still, our sense doors are still open. Maybe they're open more. It's more clarity, there's less clouds over them. And so there's clear perception, clear connectivity with the world around us and others. The doors, the window to our compassion, the doors to our compassion is open more clearly. We have capacities for empathy, compassion, care, concern for others. And so without any planning on my part, without even wanting it, that what was welling up was a desire, a responsivity to wanting to respond to the suffering of the world. And so these four vows that they had in Zen were not something that I took on from the outside, but rather they were an acknowledgement of what was beginning to germinate from within. This is how I wanted to live my life. I wouldn't say it was me, but it was kind of like, this was what's central. This was what I could rely on. This was what I could base my life on in a way that I couldn't with all these thoughts and ideas that I had. So in our tradition, we have these four resolves, and they are to be resolved on wisdom, resolved on truth, resolved on relinquishment, generosity, and resolved on peace. And wisdom has a lot to do with, I think, compassion, because it has to do with being resolved on not causing harm and rather benefiting self and others. And this idea of living a life that's beneficial for the world doesn't have to be an idea and a duty, an obligation. I think it can be an upwelling. In the same way, just as the same way that if you step on a thorn on the ground, or you pull your foot away, you pull the thorn out. It's not, You know, you don't just keep walking and let the thorn go deeper and deeper in. It's kind of just, it doesn't, you don't have to even think a lot about taking it out. It's just like, that's, of course, you take it out. Or if your friend you're walking with trips and falls, you probably don't think twice about, should I or shouldn't I offer them a hand? But you know, or you catch them as they're falling and you don't even think about it, just kind of what wells up from in it within. So the sensitivity to, this basic sensitivity to harm and non-harm, harm and benefit, I think can be seen as some kind of something that's innate. If there's not a lot of obstructions, if there's not a lot of being caught up in conceivings and fear and different things. And one doesn't have to be deeply in touch with this and be deeply connected to this kind of wisdom, this kind of understanding or insight into the simple thing of harm and benefit. But it can be inspiring to know that that's something we can rely on, that's something we can aspire to, that's something that can be our intention, resolve, to base our life on that idea. And just that's enough. Whether you can do it well or not, it's not that, you know, that's a separate issue. But it's a worthwhile place to base your life on. This I'll try to do. And then the resolves on truth. You know, the word truth can also mean to be resolved on what's real. So not what's our imaginations and abstract ideas, but something we can experience and know much more directly. And the direct experience the Buddha highlights in this discussion of the truth is Nibbana, is the experience of real deep release, where the heart is no longer contracted or tight, the mind is no longer driven by compulsions, or no longer tight with clinging or contractions. We've got the release of everything that can be associated with clinging or grasping. And there's something about that experience of release, as I talked about earlier, that that is reliable. That's a safe place. That's a place to base your life on. Partly because it makes space for some upwelling of things that are profound from within. But one of the questions is, how is it safe? How is it safe to let go so deeply? I didn't think it was safe when I had to let go of self. It took me a few years to kind of discover that it was actually safer to let go of self than it was to try to build up a self that protected me. And one of the things I learned, it's kind of like, if I was attached to myself, my self ideas and how I got seen and how I wanted to be projected to be seen by others, it's kind of like I had a target on me. And things would happen in the world and they would hit the target and it would go, ouch. But if I didn't have that operating with those ideas, if those ideas weren't up and active, then all kinds of arrows would come my way, and they would just go right through. And I, you know, they wouldn't land. They wouldn't. There was nothing for them to hit. So, is it safer to have a target that you put in a vault? You build a fort around your target. Does that make you really safe? That's one way to be safe. Have a target, and then build a fort, and put it down in the basement. Under lock. Or is it better not to have a target at all? Then you don't have to have a fort. It's a lot cheaper and a lot easier. So there's a kind of safety that can come from really deep letting go. And exactly how that works and how that's the big topic maybe, and ideally maybe a topic you discover for yourself. You kind of You're testing the waters and find out how letting go actually makes you safer. Is that possible? Or to learn how to take care of yourself when you've let go, because we're not supposed to be a pushover for people either. Someone asked a question on the board about self-defense, and I think the Buddhist idea of few things about taking care of yourself. simple things to say here is, if someone, hits your cheek, in Buddhism we don't offer them the other cheek. But the idea is we look them right in the eye. We don't turn away. We don't offer them, please do this again or something. But we look them right in the eye and let them deal with our humanity. Like, here I am. Is this what you want to do? And, there's no need to go along with it. And then also, I think it's interesting that the rule for Buddhist monastics is they have a high bar for being nonviolent. They're supposed to not have, be violent or have weapons or anything. But they're allowed to strike out in self-defense. So if someone's going to strike you, then you're allowed to, to push their arm away. But you're not allowed to hit first. But you're allowed to defend yourself. So that's kind of so the idea of defending yourself, it's allowable, but there's one little kind of requirement that goes along with it. Just a small one. You're allowed to strike out in self-defense if you can have loving kindness in your heart. Uh-oh. But that's for monastics. But it's a nice ideal to work towards. So this idea of the truth of letting go, and then relinquishment is kind of I see it as a decision to let go of some things, certain things. We see that certain things are no longer serve us, certain things are no longer helpful for us, maybe certain things are harmful, and so we say that's enough. It's a choice. I'm no longer going to do that behavior anymore. I'm tired of it. I'm done with it. So you've been smoking cigarettes for 20 years. One day you say, I'm done. I'm finished with this. That's been relinquished. That seems reasonable, right? In terms of cigarettes. What about, is there anything that you hold on to that's precious and important for you that you're getting close to the time where you think enough is enough? That you're ready to relinquish it? You're done with it? The last one is peace. And this, in some ways, the peace, I think, is certainly one of the qualities that come with liberation. But the experience of peace, at least in my experience, is the most satisfying and sublime and fulfilling kind of state of being that I know, because it has no agitation in it. It has no tension in it. No struggle within it, no for and against, just this deep state of tranquility and peace and kind of happiness just seems very nourishing, kind of like healing and settling. So the Buddha talked about, he said that in terms of wisdom, the idea is to not neglect it. So I like this word, don't neglect it, as if it's already here. Rather than acquiring it, don't neglect it. And maybe it's already here because it's not complicated, the Buddhist idea of wisdom. Don't cause harm. Do the opposite. For truth, it's to protect it. And that's also kind of peculiar. Protect the truth, again, as if it's already here. Is that true? What's already here that is true? What's already here that has freedom in it, that has liberation in it? And then for relinquishment, it's one way of understanding the Pali word is be devoted to it. That's kind of a nice, you know, where's the devotion in our practice? Some people ask sometimes, there's no devotionalism in this Theravada, Zen, Vipassana, Well, yeah, there's plenty of devotionalism. We're devoted to, our devotion is towards relinquishment. And then the fourth one is peace. And there it says to train in peace. And that's interesting that that's the one we train in. Imagine that. The training is to move towards peace, is to be peaceful. So what do you do to train to become peaceful? Probably strain. Work harder, get busy, judge yourself, decide you're not doing well enough. That kind of goes against the grain, right? It's going the opposite direction. That's very, has to be very forgiving, very generous, very there has to be peacefulness in the very way in which we train. You can't train in a way that goes against the grain with peace. There has to be peacefulness in the training. So is there some way that you can train diligently, seriously, and engage wholeheartedly, but it feels peaceful to do it? I think it's a good question to explore. And then, this word chaga also can mean generosity. And so how do we be generous to ourselves? Or how do we bring all these things together? And how do we relate to ourselves with compassion? How do we relate to ourselves don't cause harm? How do we benefit ourselves? How do we have respect for ourselves? How do we understand, the history of our life in such a way that maybe we can put things to rest, relinquish in the sense of not giving up and not giving away, but maybe putting some things to rest. And I want to tell a story, some of it which I knew about when I was a teenager growing up in the 1960s, because I'd read it about it in the newspaper. It was kind of an amazing story, that they would find in the jungles of the Philippines, they would find 20 years, 22 years, 23 years after World War II, they would find Japanese soldiers who had been living in the jungle by themselves for all these years since World War II. And it turned out that they had been sent into the jungles, told, you go in there and fight the war, be like a terrorist, I don't know what they were, guerrilla or something, and fight the war, and we'll come and get you when it's time to go home. But the war ended and no one came and got them. So they were, I guess, maybe loyal to the commands they got. So they stayed in the jungles. And then eventually someone would see them, they'd steal chickens from a farmer or something, and they'd somehow get known. And so that's just part of the story I read about. The rest of it I've heard since. Not sure if it's exactly this way, but it doesn't matter. It's such a good story. So what I was told is that so they would learn about this Japanese soldiers in the jungle fighting World War II in 1965. And they would bring the most senior military officer from World War II out of retirement, and he put on his best uniform and a samurai sword, ceremonial sword, and he'd walk through the jungle calling out in Japanese, come out, come out. And the soldier would come out. And the first thing that the general would do is he would bow deeply down to the soldier and say, thank you. Thank you for your service to the homeland. Thank you, thank you, thank you. He would take him to a boat and he'd be treated like a hero. And they would take him back to Japan. And then just before getting off the boat, again, they say, thank you for all you did, for your service you did. Thank you. And by the way, the war is over. It's been over for 20 years. And then they disembark. So there are maybe some of you who are still fighting wars that are 20 years old or longer, that are long since finished. but somehow the heart or the neurons haven't gotten the message, haven't gotten the news. But what's so significant about this story, why it touched me so much, was this idea of saying thank you, this act of generosity, this act of not causing more harm, but what is beneficial here? What is respectful? And, you know, I think that many of us have hugely difficult lives, and we try to do the best we can, and some of us only survived our lives because of certain kind of defenses and a certain kind of strategies that we took. And we got through it, but then those strategies and those defenses, those responses, became habituated or became the place to feel safe. And so they continued for years and years. But what kind of wisdom, what kind of truth, what kind of relinquishment, what kind of peace, what kind of generosity is found in bowing deep to them and saying, thank you. Thank you for what you did for me. Thank you for what you got me out of the challenges I had. And now, you can retire. I can put you to rest. And that's not a one-time thing, that can't just do it just like that, but it's a process of appreciation, process of respect of all these things that we struggle with. And this idea of thank you, and the war is over. Thank you. And it's safe now from that danger that we had. So to the alternative to this life of conceiving, life of imagination, is to base a life on these four resolves, certain kind of intentions. And it's quite powerful to live a life based on intentions, to clarify, to purify, to kind of work on our intentionality, what our intentions are, and find intentions to live by that are helpful. When I was at Zen Center, San Francisco, doing Zen practice, one of the definitions that I was given for what Zen practice is Zen practice is the purification of intention. And I found that I spent time when I was at Zen Center reflecting a lot about what is the intention about how I want to live my life. What is the intention I want to live this day? And I would do it, for 1 year I did it every day. It was kind of an exercise I did. What is my deepest intention? And to ask that question every day, what is my deepest intention? I found that I'd have all kinds of answers, but then the answers would go deeper and deeper. Deeper and deeper. And I found that sometimes my answers to that question were stated in the negative. Like I would say, my deepest intention is to live without fear. So that's pretty good. But then I found out that if I, instead of said without fear, I would ask myself, well, what's the positive aspect of that? If I had no fear, then what would be my deepest intention? So the idea is, if the answer is negative, a negative statement, like, then don't stop there. Take it a little bit further. Then what? Well, if I had no fear, then my intention is to live from love. And that's more interesting than just living without fear. I mean, you know, it's pretty good to be without fear, but, you know, it was good to have this idea of love or compassion. And to get clear about what are the values, what's the purpose, what's the intention, the motivations that we want to base our life on. And that can be something that supports us. As we leave this retreat, what you have to understand is that the experiences you have here, you can't hold on to. Some of the lessons of those experiences might benefit you, but the experience, you can't stay calm if you're calm. And you're all calmer than you realize. So if you're saying, I'm not calm, just wait. The calm, the concentration, the stillness, the strength of mindfulness, the intimacy you have with yourself. There's so many things that you can't really, they come and go. These things are come and go. They can be strengthened, they can be more around more often, they can, but you can't really expect them to stay. Some of the strengths that develop can stay longer. So you might have a strength of equanimity or a strength of mindfulness that develops. But a state of mindfulness, states come and go, but strengths maybe can be stronger over time as we train. But it's also possible to have intentions and discover intentions that you want to base your life on. So when it's changing world that we go back to, we can carry with us the intentions as the grounding, as the baseline, as the ballast. We can carry along the intentions as the guide for how we want to live this life. And those intentions can kind of see us through great difficulty. Because we say, what am I going to do in this great difficult situation? Oh, well, I have these intentions. These intentions are worth sticking to. This is a difficult situation. I don't know what to do. But my intention is not to cause harm. That can be powerful. Just that. My intention is to find out what's true here. My intention is not to cling to anything in the situation and to find my way without clinging. My intention is to see, where's the peace? Can we find the peace? Can I be peaceful in this situation, even though everyone else is in conflict? Or there might be other intentions you have. Those are just the ones we've been talking about. But intentions you can carry with you, because they're not exactly states. They're not things, but they're kind of like aspirations that we want to live by. And they're aspirations that are worthwhile living by. Maybe in some way or other, they're found within. And so what you're doing is giving voice, giving expression to something that maybe over time you discover is actually kind of who you are deep inside. That this is a welling up of an understanding, of a sense, of a something. So sometimes I've said in the past that, when people leave retreat, I'll say, a common instruction is, it's really good to sit regularly, to meditate regularly. I suppose I should say that. I'm a meditation teacher. But I actually think that it's more important is every day to reflect on what is your deepest intention. What are your intentions you want to base your life on that day? And if meditation supports that, or if meditation is an expression of that, then meditate. But if you have to discover your deepest intentions, how you most deeply want to live your life, and meditation has no relationship to it, I don't know. I guess, don't meditate. Why would you? There's probably better things to do then. Your deepest intention is valuable. Your deepest intention is kind of like your treasure. And I have such a tremendous confidence that in the depths of people's hearts, there are wonderful qualities of intentionality that exist there. That if we can just kind of relax and settle and open and allow ourselves to be in contact with what's most deep, that's trustable. We can trust our intentions there. But we have to go through the layers of other things that are in the way, the other intentions that are not so trustable. So in this discourse the Buddha gives, when he mentions the four resolves, it gets a little bit trippy, at least in my reading of it. So I'll read it, and you can see if it's what you think of this. So the Buddha said, one should not neglect wisdom, one should preserve truth, should cultivate, or here it's cultivate, but could also mean be devoted to relinquishment, and should train for peace. So if it says, and he says, the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these resolves. You're standing on dry ground. The tides of conceivings don't sweep you off. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over one, one is called a sage at peace. And with reference to what was this said? Practitioners, I am is a conceiving. I am X is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. I shall be possessed of form is a conceiving. I shall be formless is a conceiving. I shall be conscious. I think it's here he's talking about what happens after you die. I shall be conscious is a conceiving. I shall be non-conscious is a conceiving. Conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a dart, an arrow. By overcoming all conceivings, one is called a sage at peace. And here's the trippy part. A sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die, is not shaken, does not yearn. For there is nothing present in that one by which one might be born. Not being born, how could one age? Not aging, how could one die? Not dying, how can one be shaken? Not shaken, what is there to, what could they, what should they yearn? So a sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die, is not shaken, does not yearn. So wouldn't it be nice, this is like, you know, it seems like they're finally pointing to the elixir of immortality, right? You know, this is a great dream. You make a lot of money in America if you can figure out how not to age. You know, and on top of that, if you can figure out how not to die, I mean, that's like even better, right? And, you know, and here the Buddha says, all you have to do is stop conceiving. So this is a serious thing. Yes, we can say that there's aging. Yes, we can say there's dying. But if you look around this room, at the space in this room, in the space itself, is there aging? Is there dying? Is there birth? If you look at your hand, and only stay in the present moment with the experience of the hand just in and of itself, is the hand born? Does it age? Does it die? The hand is just a hand. It's just the sensations of the hand are there. They come and go. To have the idea of aging is to live in a mind which is making comparisons. Living in a mind that's living a little bit of abstraction, remembering what was, recognizing what is, and somehow making a little story out of that. To have the idea that you're going to die is an idea, it's a conceiving. You will, but is that here now? I had all this conceiving about the plans for the future, fears of the future. They were conceivings that didn't prove true, like I said earlier. I can have plans and fears and ideas about dying, those are also conceivings. Right here, what if there was no conceiving about aging, about death, about birth? What if our thoughts about so many of our ideas that we live on, so many of the projections, so many assigning of meaning, so many of the predictions that we live with, so many of the concepts we live with, maybe if you really pay attention to how these concepts, these ideas are living, how they really are, they're kind of like taking watercolors, dipping your brush into the watercolor to paint, and then you paint your picture on a running stream of water. As soon as you put your brush down, you know, the watercolors spread out. And so this trippy idea that we live in a world of conceiving, and what happens if we can relinquish, let go, release ourselves from the grip of the ideas that we live under? Can we take that step into the abyss, over the cliff, where we're not projecting, we're not painting reality with ideas and thoughts. We're not measuring past, present, and future. We're not comparing ourselves better, worse, or equal to others. There's no conceit, ideas of who I am. But rather, maybe, what if, instead of conceiving who we are, an idea of who we are, an idea of who other people are, what if who we are is an opening, like a door that's open? There's nothing in the open door. But what if we're the open door, the opening in the door? Someone comes along with their paintbrushes and they try to paint in the opening of the door. It's even less successful than in the river, because the air is not going to take the paint. So the people come and, or what if we come with ideas and thoughts and concepts about our life and the future and the present? And what if our mind produces thoughts, but what if those, we see those thoughts as if they're being painted on an open door, open space? The thoughts can have this lack of solidity. They have no weight. They're kind of a virtual reality. Is that the only reality we want to live in? The reality of our ideas and concepts and thoughts and imaginations and projections? Is there another place to be? The open door, there's no target in the door. There's nothing that can be hit. And, you know, you might protest what I'm saying because other people will want to harm you. But what about when we harm ourselves? What if we're an open door, and so our thoughts that we have, the feelings we have, they can arise, but they don't land anywhere. We don't pick them up. We see them as thoughts. We have respect for them. We can use them if they're useful. But we don't have to let them use us. And so this kind of idea of, for a sage at peace, there's no birth, no aging, and no death, I understand to be, you know, bordering on a mystical experience. But it's not really mystical, it's kind of ordinary. I hope it becomes really ordinary. But it's so different than a world that's based on conceiving and ideas. So here, What is here? What is here between your thoughts? Who are you when you do not use thoughts to answer the question? Maybe there are thoughts, but maybe there's no need to posit a thinker of the thoughts. Maybe there's seeing, and no need to have ideas of there being a seer. Maybe there are sounds, and no need to posit or live in the ideas that there's a hearer. Tastes, and no taster. Smell and no smeller. Sensations in the body and no sensor. There's a certain logic to say, yes, there is all these things. There's logic to that. I'm here, I'm hearing, who else is going to do it? So it has some truth to it, but that truth, you know, it's useful and has its place, but relies on conceiving, relies on thoughts and concepts, relies on a certain kind of contraction and coming together that doesn't have to be there all the time. So here, just here. How fully can you look beyond the thoughts? How fully can you look beyond the seer? How fully can you allow yourself, allow there to be the completely open door in which there can flow life in all directions, in and out. And so the deeper aspirations, the vows, the deep intentions that can exist, that can well up from the inside, can flow freely through that door into the world. They're intentions that don't depend on conceptions of self, but think we can base our life on them. And what if those open doors, being an open door, is a place where our life around us can flow into us? And so that there is no hard lines and walls between self and other, but there's a flow of mutuality, of connectivity, that allows something deeper to happen that can't happen if we have too many ideas of what that's supposed to be.